say it's because of the dual class shares or, oh yeah, I mean, it's just, it's
swept. Which is like even more governance.
Yeah, sit right up front, right?
Sit up front and left, ask lots of questions.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, good to see you again, yeah.
I didn't know you were the investment guy, we can talk offline.
Okay, that sounds great.
You're cheering squad.
I know.
Well, you're on the cheering squad, that was smart.
Yeah, I need the support, I think.
Keep it lively.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, you're great, you're great, you're great.
It's unusual to have people who are sitting in the front row.
And on an investment thing as well, right?
So, I was imagining that when we did the scenarios, we would have tables because that's how it was in the other one.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how you want to do it here.
I don't know, we could.
But, you know, like.
And they can't even pull the chairs apart, I don't think, so it'd be hard to really.
You can't pull the chairs apart?
The chairs are interlocked, I think you have to lift them.
Yeah, I don't think we want to make them out of the chairs either.
So, I mean, I think people should get up and go into groups.
Yeah.
You know, we can say 5 to 7 people or something like that.
I was going to say, we could just do one group of.
No, I think it's actually, at this time of day, it's hard to sort of sit and listen.
And that's what I was going to say, I was originally just going to have people talk and just only and then Q and A, but I added a little handout thing.
Good.
To eat up some of the time, so it's not quite so dry.
Yep.
A little bit more interactive.
No problem.
But it shouldn't impact your time, speaking time.
I think, yeah, I mean, if we have a half an hour for talking at people about my experiences, that's.
That's about it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And I'm intending.
People break into groups and have a discussion?
I wouldn't be in more than 5 minutes.
I'm just going to frame it up, so I'm letting you guys run with the ball.
I was going to just talk about our advocacy on LGBT.
That's great.
Which today seems like a good day to talk about.
It does. It's like you can.
So you've just, they've just set you up very nicely.
That was so sweet of them.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court that set me up.
I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
I was like,
thank
you. I chatted with Justice Roberts.
Okay.
I asked if he could release it this morning, and he had something to talk about this evening.
Yeah. And he did you a personal favor.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, thank you, you know, for making the ask and having the relationship, because we're all going to benefit.
Exactly.
If you want, it's an action shot.
Yeah, I know. I guess we already, you know, yacked it up, but in any event, that was pretty cool news today.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
That's right there.
Yeah.
If not completely.
Yeah, but it just happened so fast. That's what I keep hearing from people.
Yeah.
Well, it took kind of a little while.
It depends on who you
started,
you know.
Kind of a while ago.
Yeah.
How 50 years.
Yeah.
But,
exactly.
But it seems fast.
But also, I sort of feel like if we can do marriage equality, we can do racial equality. I mean, I just sort of feel like.
Oh, there's a lot that can be done.
It just, you know, I know it didn't happen overnight, but I feel like, okay, that was pretty amazing. So maybe.
Maybe there's other opportunities.
It provides. Yeah, it does provide sort of the guideposts for a campaign.
Yeah.
They sit there and say, how did you do it?
Yeah. Well, it was not by accident.
No, not at all. There's a lot of work going on.
Yeah.
I've been going to Gill Foundation events for years, and I'm like, work going on.
Yeah, pretty
exciting. You know, in the grassroots level, making sure it's building.
Phenomenal.
Hello, everyone. I would like to welcome you to the socially responsible investing session, using investment for social change, session number 356. I'm David Stewart. I chair the Socially Responsible Investment Committee. I'll be framing up the discussion briefly today so that these folks can tell you all about their socially responsible investing activities. We often think of socially responsible investments in four main groupings. First, we have positive and negative screening based on previous GA resolutions with regard to the UUA, such as not investing in munitions or tobacco while weighting the portfolio towards better SRI performers. Second, we have proxy voting, which is relevant when shareholders vote for resolutions. And this is the place where activist shareholders can change corporate behavior. Third, we have impact investing, where we are directly investing both for a profit and for a social or environmental impact. And finally, we have community investing, where we invest 1% of our portfolio at a very low rate of return so that we can help bring capital to communities that do not have much access to capital. The other members of this panel today are, first, at my far left is Vonda Brunsting. She's also a member of the Socially Responsible Investment Committee. In her day job, she does corporate responsibility campaigns for the SEIU. To her right is Charlene Brown. She is the National Director of Oiko Credit USA. She has 15 years of experience in the social responsible investment field, most of that in the microfinance sector. She has traveled to nearly 50 countries around the world. And to my immediate left is Matt Patsky, the CEO of Trillium Asset Management. Trillium is a leader in the social responsible investing field and has often been a good partner with the UUA, especially when engaging in shareholder activism. So without further ado, let me hand it off to Matt, if you'd like to go first.
Great. No, thank you. And I want to sort of pay a very personal and deep thank you to the Unitarian Church after today's Supreme Court decision. I'll tell you a little bit about my history. First, I want to apologize for being in a suit and tie. I will tell you, I was raised Catholic, and I heard church, and I thought I should be dressed up, so here I am, and when I got here, I was like, whoa, that was a mistake. People dress comfortably for Unitarian, yeah, so, if I come back, I will dress more comfortably. There are some people in suits and ties? Thank you. I appreciate it. Oh, good. All right. So if Tim can wear a suit, I can wear a suit. All right. Thank you. I grew up in a Roman Catholic household that was blue collar and very deeply religious, struggling with my own sexuality and not coming to terms with it until I had moved to New York City. And I moved to Brooklyn Heights, 50 Clark Street, and around the corner, just a block and a half on Monroe Place, was the entrance to the First Unitarian Congregational Society. Gay pride flag outside with a sign, all are welcome. That, I have to tell you, moved me in many ways, and I have to tell you to this day, I can tell you I was just incredibly surprised given the response I get from the Roman Catholic Church about the feelings I was having, and excited to see that there was a religious institution that was embracing and welcoming of the LGBT community. It turned out that was the meeting place for numerous meetings through my 10 years in Brooklyn for LGBT organizations working on equality. And so I am really well aware of all of the work that was being done in the early days and through the AIDS epidemic by the Unitarian Church. So thank you, one and all. I was able, as I was working in the financial services industry, I started looking at issues of social and environmental impact in the investment process. I was an analyst at Lehman Brothers, and yes, it's that Lehman Brothers. I was a sell-side analyst following first technology and then consumer. I worked on the inclusion of environmental and social issues in the investment reports, and was famously in my, and I should say famously, the one line that I most remember is my associate director of research calling me into his office after reading one of my reports and saying, Matt, it is really great that you care about these issues, but if you don't stop, it'll destroy your career. And I was able to meet a number of great people in Boston who were working on these issues, Boston and around the country, but Boston was a hub of looking at socially responsible investing, and met a wonderful woman who had founded Trillium Asset Management, Joan Bavaria, who was doing a lot of work particularly around the issue of shareholder advocacy and corporate engagement on a number of issues on the theory that we can buy companies that are better in terms of their environmental and social profile, but we should continue to push them to improve their social and environmental profile. And she was working on the issue of LGBT equality from the 80s on the theory that, which is interesting now after today, that we would never make progress in the courts or in the state houses or in Congress, but we could win over corporations. And if we could focus on changing the behavior of corporations towards the LGBT community, we could swing public opinion and ultimately win at least some level of equality, which I have to say is amazing to watch where how far we've come. But the first effort was really to just simply get protection based on sexual orientation into the non-discrimination clauses of companies. We were largely successful as you go through the 90s, and the 90s saw tremendous progress, and it became easier and easier. And then starting in the sort of 95 to 2000, adding gender equality, gender identity to try to protect the transgendered community. And I was just commenting that it's become easier and easier on gender identity because companies are now finding it embarrassing to try to come up with a negative response to that request in a shareholder proposal. So if you look at our track record in filing those requests, they are two-thirds of them are being withdrawn successfully because the company, when they go to write the negative response, can't come up with anything that would look suitable for being read for public consumption. So tremendous progress there. But there is tremendous progress obviously being made on a number of issues, and I just wanted to say, if for those who don't feel that there is opportunity to change and have impact through public market, I think they're mistaken, because there is clear evidence of the success we can have, and today's Supreme Court decision, I would say, is a testament to that. Thank you.
So good afternoon. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Great. I'm going to take a note from Matt and perhaps start with my own personal journey. So I was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and I moved to the United States when I was 6 years old, so I've had most of my formal education here in the United States. I was fortunate enough to go to Wellesley College, where I got my undergraduate degree in economics. And it was during that time that I really focused on the role that I had as a citizen in the world and how I could perhaps shape the behavior of corporations that worked in developing countries and did things at home that would not be, did things there that they would not be allowed at home. And many of that meant that a lot of people in developing countries lost out. So I accidentally stumbled on social responsible investing just after I graduated from college and went to work for a firm called Domini Social Investments, which is often recognized as one of the leading organizations in the social responsible investing movement. And so there I really got an introduction and education to how we as investors can change the world through our investment decisions and the way that we allocate our portfolio. And it was certainly in that time that I learned about community investing and realized that that was a way for me to make a difference in the world. And then from there, I stumbled into what's called microfinance. So microfinance is the provision of very small loans, typically to poor women around the world. It tends to benefit women more so than men. And the intention behind that is that women are the one that often have the greatest responsibilities in families in developing countries, but they have the least economic resources and the least rights. Through my work for Grameen Foundation, I traveled to numerous places around the world, and I worked with Oikocredit as an organization. It was essentially my client organization to help to really focus on the social impact side. So Oikocredit knows the financial side really well. They've been doing it now for 40 years. But the social piece was the piece that they were really looking at. Now, a little bit of history behind Oikocredit. It was founded by a group called the World Council of Churches in 1975. The idea for Oikos Credit came out of a 1968 World Council of Churches General Assembly, where the churches at the time were reflecting on the use of their capital. So they had their money in the big banks of the day. Some of you may have remembered chemical banks, which later became now today's J.P. Morgan Chase, sort of if you look at the iteration. And certainly it was churches in the United States, but also Western Europe and a number of countries around the world. And the idea was that these banks lend your money out, and you have absolutely no say in how that money is lent. And so the churches thought, well, we should create something that looks like a bank, but where we get to say how the funds are used. And so they created what they call the Ecumenical Development Cooperative Society. So today we're known as Oikos Credit, and that comes from the Greek term oikos, which means home or community. So we extend credit for building homes and communities around the world. The idea was really that from the very inception that the churches around the world wanted to create an organization that created economic opportunity for low-income individuals in developing countries. And so that was always at the heart of Oikos Credit. The second thing that was there was that they didn't want to go in with what they considered to be the Western development approach. They wanted to ensure that there was dialogue between the global North and the global South. And that meant that the cooperative had to reflect the world. So if you look at the membership of our cooperative today, more than half of the church and church-related organizations are from the so-called global South. And the other sort of 45% are from developed countries, Europe, so Germany, Austria, also from North America, Canada, and the United States. So that was really important. That meant that there was a dialogue in place, a dialogue happening about development and what was appropriate. So from the very early days, we quickly learned that in order to be highly successful as an investor in a developing world, that we had to have feet on the ground, and that those boots on the ground could not look like most of us, right? That they had to be people from those countries, people who understand the culture, who speak the languages, because that was what was going to have the greatest impact. And so today, Oikos Credit is close to a $1 billion organization. We raise investment capital from 53,000 investors from around the world. If I tell you, our largest market is actually Germany with over $400 million, Austria second with over $100 million, the Netherlands third with about $90 million, and the U.S. is fourth with $40 million. So we reach, through our microfinance partners, 37 million people, and 86% of that population are women. Now, what's also important about our methodology is that we, like a traditional social investor, screen our portfolio, and we do lots of advocacy with our partners. So these are not public companies. They're private organizations, oftentimes NGOs or nonprofits or other cooperatives. But we engage with them just as strongly to ensure that the social impact that we desire and that our membership within the cooperative aims to achieve can be achieved. We recognize that organizations are not perfect because obviously they're made of human beings, right? And the idea there is that when we find those weaknesses, we go in and we provide grants to support the development of organizations. So I want to say thank you to Unitarians because we have been supported by the UUAs for many, many years. And we've got a number of UUA congregations that are investing, and certainly at the national level as well. And so I want to thank you for your support.
Good afternoon. So again, I'm Vonda Brunsting, and I'm a very proud member of the First Unitarian Universalist Society in Brooklyn, the congregation that Matt found when he moved to Brooklyn Heights many years ago. And I'm also honored to serve as a member of the Social Responsible Investment Committee for the UUA. So I work for the labor movement as an organizer, doing social responsibility campaigns. And before the labor movement, I actually worked as a community organizer in the faith-based community. And so I feel like I have been able to, I feel like my work is seamless. My work in the congregation and my work at SEIU. But I started really as an organizer with, for people who know it, the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was started by Saul Alinsky, and some of you may be familiar with his writing and his work over 50, 75 years ago. And one of the things I learned was that power comes from organized people, which is what community organizations do, organized people, but also organized money. And the organized money part is really where I find myself these days. And so I want to just talk a bit about the organized money that we have within the Unitarian community and also within the labor movement and in the broader institutional investor community, because I think it's a power that is not untapped, but potentially could be tapped even more than it is now. So our fund, the Common Fund, is small. 200 million? I don't know exactly how much it is. Is that right? So we are able, with our endowment fund, to partner with organizations that are doing similar work to what we want to do, right? So, for example, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which Tim Brennan is on the board of, we have a seat at that table, which includes assets from all sorts of religious communities around the country. And so we can then collaborate, engage, and have more of a say, right? In the labor movement where I sit, our pension funds, our members participate in, we have 200,000 members in CalPERS, which is the largest pension fund in the US, and it's, actually I don't know. I think it's 250 billion. Does that sound right? And so we're able to then partner with other pension funds who are also engaged with companies, and we have a bigger voice, right? 60 or maybe it's 65% of the money in the S&P comes from institutional investors, right? So that means that we make up the investors of most major companies. If we can organize that capital, that gives us the ability to create change at those companies. And so that's what we really do with on the SRI committee. Through the Common Fund, we're able to get a seat at these tables and engage as shareholders in a way that we couldn't really on our own. And so I just want to give people one example, which is very close to the work that I've done the last couple of months, and that is a group of investors really led by CalPERS and also the pension funds in New York City said, you know, how come is it that shareholders don't get a say on who's on the board of ExxonMobil or McDonald's or Dow Chemical? Because those companies don't want us to have a seat on the board. But what if we actually were able to nominate people to sit on those boards? And so they devise a strategy called proxy access, which would go to these companies and say, if certain criteria are met, could we nominate people to these boards? And the initiative being led by the city controller in New York, Scott Stringer, chose 75 companies to file shareholder resolutions at, and they picked the 75 based on those companies that needed change at their boards. And the reasons that they needed change was because they weren't addressing climate risk. They were completely white boards and male for the most part. And the third reason was that their executive comp was not off the charts, because they're all off the charts, but even worse than most of the companies. And they then filed these proposals and were able, in sort of an amazing effort over this spring, to pass those resolutions at the majority of the companies that they engaged. We were a small part of that, both where I sit at SEIU, but also through the Common Fund. We were able to, in some cases, send people to present those shareholder resolutions, because if you imagine, the city controller's office had to go to 75 shareholder meetings, and if you don't show up and present your resolution, they can kick it off. And so, through our congregations and our networks, we were able to send people to these shareholder meetings. So I have a sign-up sheet. So if people are willing, and especially in places that are not New York City or the Bay Area, there's companies that are based in your hometown. And if you're willing next shareholder season to go and present a resolution, that would be great. Has anyone ever done that before in the room? All right. So talk to me afterwards. I actually got my mom to do one 2 years ago. So I always tell people, if my mom can do it, anyone can do it in West Michigan. So then I want to just talk about one other thing really quick. Is that all right?
Sure.
Do I have more time? So the issue of climate has come up a lot. And I sit on a pension fund board for SEIU. We manage the retirement savings of janitors and other workers in property services. And we've had people come and say, we need to divest from fossil fuels. And other of our members who say, look, that's my retirement money. You know, don't use it for your social cause. It needs to be there for when I retire. And so I sit on a board where there are people who actually don't believe in climate change. And so this, in this sort of complicated environment, we said, what can we do as a small investor, right? It's a $1.5 billion fund, and we have no staff, no investment staff. So we have a consultant who manages all of our money. And so what we did is we actually partnered with some organizations over this past year to develop a toolkit for investors, because we felt like saying that we can't divest is not enough. But we also recognize that if we want to look at everything from the risk in our portfolio that's related to climate, as well as the opportunities to invest in the new economy, we needed some way of doing that. We needed a process to have a conversation. And so the toolkit really guides people through a conversation at their board, and then the steps that they need to take in order to look at these issues. And so I don't know if anyone sits on a retirement fund or through your congregation's investments is interested in it, but we're just finishing drafting it. I have a couple copies of the toolkit, and I'll make sure that it gets on the website so people can use it going forward. So that's my my piece.
Great. And that website, by the way, is uucef.org. That's the UU Common Endowment Fund.org. I also wanted to bring up one other thing. I framed it up earlier about impact investing, and I wanted to note that recently the UUA started doing some illiquid investments, and one in particular that's fairly exciting for me is it's with a manager by the name of Brockton. And so we've put $5 million with Brockton in a fairly long-term locked-up situation, but what they do is they buy real estate in London, and they essentially convert that older in need of renovation real estate using the equivalent to LEED in Europe, fix it up to a brand kind of sparkling new facility, and then sell it for top dollar in the London market. And it's usually near the rail systems or mass transit. And so this, we feel like it's a great impact, because 30% of the carbon dioxide emissions come from buildings. So we're very proud of that as an impact investment. While at the same time feel that that's very good for our returns. So I just thought I'd throw that one out there as well as another as one in another category. At this point, if you all would like to do a quick Q&A, I'd like to reserve a little bit of time at the end, because I have a sort of an interactive piece that I'd like to hand out to you all, a piece of paper that I'd like you to work through in small groups. But while we have, while this is fresh on your mind, I would encourage you, if you have any questions, to come to the mic and ask a few questions, and then we can do these small group exercise.
I'm sorry, I don't know if the Common Fund.
Your name and
I'm Linda Green, Spokane Unitarian Universalist Church.
Thanks.
Is the Common Fund all of the money from the UUA? Because we have an endowment fund that is with you, and I understand you also have the staff pension fund. Is that all put together?
I don't believe the staff pension fund is put into the common endowment fund. Approximately half of the fund is UUA money, and approximately half is several hundred of the congregations around the United States.
So it's not all UUA?
It is not all UUA money. No, it is not. In fact, we encourage, I guess I should make a quick pitch here. We feel like that it's really important for congregations to be able to have a good alternative, a balanced, well-managed, inexpensive portfolio option, and we feel like we are a complete solution for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd encourage anyone who has endowment money or responsibility for that, especially if you feel that your endowment committee
lacks fiduciary, previous fiduciary experience or anything like that, that you seriously consider the UU Common Endowment Fund.
Thank you, Tim. No, we do manage a tremendous amount of money for churches around the country, including Unitarian churches, and have the ability to certainly handle smaller, and you know, endowments for individual congregations, managed in alignment with the values of the church.
Okay, but the UUA is with you, not
the UUA
with,
is with
not yeah, with
it's
you.
Tim. Tim is managing.
Okay.
Well,
through
the investment, the investment committee of the UUA is delegated that responsibility, the fiduciary responsibility, by the Board of Trustees, and often Tim executes that with the assistance of our consultant, our investment consultant.
I'm sorry, I have another question here.
Okay.
Do you use the Palestine-Israel question in your figuring out whether you're going to invest in a...
Currently, what we are trying to better implement human rights as the screen that most directly addresses that issue. We do not have a direct screen about investing in Israel, nor do we have a direct screen about Israel-Palestine at this point in time.
Are you considering it?
If there becomes a time that there is sufficient grounding, what we feel is sufficient grounding for that, in other words, passing of a resolution or a board, business resolution by the General Assembly, then that
would take that.
That okay. would ground it. We to make it clear, the SRI committee does not lead on deciding what issues are important. The General Assembly and Board of Trustees do, and then we do our best to implement those decisions.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
My name's Rory Moore. I'm a delegate from the Unitarian Society of Santa Barbara and a retired member of SEIU.
Oh, great. And do you have a pension fund?
Yes.
Good.
Yes. It's a whole other discussion, but...
talk to me afterwards.
We support defined benefit plans.
Great.
In any event, that different discussion. Mm-hmm. But the question is for you. On the shareholder, the shareholder mm-hmm. motions, mm-hmm. You say you've presented a number of them. You've been able to present a number of them. Do you have anybody on any boards at this point?
Oh,
you've nominated, I assume, but
yeah. So, you know, folks probably know corporate boards.
Mm-hmm.
I already mentioned what they look like, but they also tend to be sort of, you know, everyone who goes to the same country club. This is how it works in America. And we believe that there needs to be some disruption on company boards, which is why we were supportive of this initiative I described. And we have worked with a couple of large pension funds like CalPERS and CalSTRS, which are the big public employee and teacher funds in California, to actually develop a whole, you know, like companies will say, well, we don't have anyone else to put on our boards. They need to be specialists in whatever these sort of, you know, manufacturing or food services. So we've been gathering names of people, actually, that would serve as good board members and have the credentials to do it in order for us to be able to put people on the board. So now with the spring shareholder resolutions,
mm-hmm.
we're starting to figure out, okay, so what are the couple of companies that we need to actually go and say, you need someone on your board who can deal with climate in a way that, you know, redirects the company, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is not just sort of passively, you know, doing the same thing that they're always doing, or who's going to really take on the issue of executive comp, because right now you're all just a bunch of yes folks, right? So I think it's hopefully a way we're building towards being able to do that with this sort of shareholder initiative that I described.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathleen McLeod from the First Church of San Diego. Our church, so far as I know, we have no investment committee because I believe all of our endowment is with the UUA. But what I want to, but I personally have all of my money in a socially responsible, it's being managed by a socially responsible firm in San Diego. And I am very interested in shareholder advocacy, but I can't get connected anywhere. And what I would like to wonder about, I was introduced to As You Sow, but I haven't really followed up on that. But in the same firm I was working, he was trying to get his customers kind of working around doing some share, some advocacy. But my question is, does the UUA or do you then find out in where you're going, do you find out if there's individual church members who can then also add to your advocacy and get and support that if they have shares in that firm?
We would love to have that. I mean, in general, what we're looking for most relevantly, because we operate on a shoestring budget, we're looking for someone local who can go to the meeting, look the board of directors in the eye, tell them that what they're doing needs to change, and make the case to them directly. I think that's probably the more important thing than trying to vote a handful of shares.
Oh, okay.
Often it's difficult to vote shares via mutual funds, for instance. So it's often the retail investor, it's a very difficult thing.
Oh.
But with regard to the, we would love to have folks from all around the country who are willing to step up to the mic and make the case.
Oh,
the
I'd
boards.
Love to, but San Diego, I think, is void of any.
Oh no, there's companies. We always have, sort of in that area. Yeah, we'll put your name on the list. We'll
because
get you
we can't.
There.
We think that there's not a hub at all for corporate headquarters.
Yeah, I think that there are some. I mean, they're not all as large and iconic as Exxon, but
oh
lots
well,
of
then maybe that's it. Maybe
yeah.
they're pretty small.
So
but the second question
can
I had.
Can I just add to what what David said? So I think that the mutual funds is something that we really need to tackle, right? Because they actually don't vote their shares in any way but with management, for the most part. It's an overstatement, but for the most part. So we did a couple of, I guess, experiments last year with some of us. And for example, at Domino's Pizza, horrible executive comp practices. And we made the case and then put a call out and said, if you have money in Vanguard, tell them that they need to vote this way on the shareholder resolution. And they actually shut down the phone lines at Vanguard. And Vanguard called us and said, who are you guys and what are you doing?
Oh, that'd be wonderful, Novak. Yeah.
So I feel like there's got to be more we can do. I mean, you know, I'm a strong believer in sort of bringing, you know, like having people band together around these, mm-hmm. you know, dollars that we haven't. Because it's not. Corporations have so much power, so much money, but if we add up all of ours, I just feel like there's more we can do with it, and the mutual funds is sort of uncharted
that
territory.
Would be good.
You said some of us did something. Explain what some of us
is. Oh, so some of us is sort of like, I would say, Move On, sort of our version in the U.S., and they do online campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so they were able to sort of put a call out to all of their members and just... You know,
S-U-M.
Yes, it's some, yes, S-U-M.
Oh, okay.
We did another one at Duke Energy with them where, you remember, people remember what happened last year at Duke Energy with the coal ash spill. And we said, you know what, the board's got to step up and make some changes, and they weren't. And so we had people who had funds, right, individual shares through the mutual funds, send emails. And, you know, I just think that there's more for us to experiment with that.
Yeah. The second question, just... Your city treasurer, or was it comptroller?
The comptroller.
I mean, is he she or he? Are they elected? What? I've never heard of city official going out and.
I know, it's great.
What's that? Tell more about that.
So pension funds and so the public employees in this country, for the most part, if they're a member of ours or other unions, have defined benefit pension plans, and each state pools those monies and manages them through a board, and often the state treasurer or the state controller has a seat on the board. And so we've been able to work with these friendly elected officials and say, you need to use your bully pulpit on behalf of the investors.
Yes.
And I think, you know, the California controller's done a lot of work, city treasurer of Chicago we've worked with, the treasurer of Ohio and of Massachusetts. So I think that there are folks who are looking at their power in these assets and trying to really use them in a way that you know, kind of flies against the business as usual. The state treasurer of Massachusetts is the chair of their fund. It's $50 billion, I think, in Massachusetts, and just came out with the most amazing proxy voting guidelines, almost as amazing as ours. And in there, you know, they vote against resolutions that don't take into account, you know, the sort of the best governance practices that Matt described and others of us have been promoting. And that really came because the treasurer said, I don't care what the naysayers are going to do. We're going to make these changes because we have to go up against the corporations and the business as usual.
Okay. Well, so. Thank you. Okay.
I'm Keith Krajcik from Northwest Unitarian Universalist in Atlanta. And I have a question for Ms. Brown. Can you tell us a little bit more about the way that Oikos is structured and the where the funding comes from and how you work in competition with or alongside of banks in the United States and in other countries?
And how do you spell it?
Yes.
Okay, so how do you spell Oikos? It's O-I-K-O. Credit. And I often tell people, think of the Greek yogurt Oikos. And drop the S. Yeah. So that's the term. So we don't really compete with banks in the U.S. The competition would be primarily with banks in developing countries. And there is some of that. The reality is that when Oikos Credit began in 1975, the type of financial services that we did was not done by anyone. So in many markets, you will find that we are pioneers. We were first there. Now that we have helped the organizations on the ground, whether they're microfinance institutions or cooperatives, to establish a track record, you will find that banks are now willing to lend to them. So then the challenge that we have is our pricing versus the bank's pricing in the local context. Now in a country like Bulgaria, for example, our loans are actually slightly more expensive than the banks there, but our partners stay with us because we do more than banking services. We do a lot of value add. So in Bulgaria, we have an agricultural sort of consortium. We bring our farmers together to do best practices. Banks won't do that. That's not the nature of most banks. But because we're in the business of really building our partners' capacity, they recognize it and they realize that there's a cost to that in the provision of those services, so they're willing to stay with us. We work in 63 countries around the world, so every country looks different. And how we compete in those countries varies. With respect to our funding structure, so we are a financial cooperative, and so for many Americans who are not familiar with cooperatives, although some are, think of a credit union. And the idea behind our cooperative structure was that each member of our cooperative, of which there are nearly 600, have one vote. And the idea was that regardless of sort of the power of your wallet, you get one say. So we've got some small African churches and Latin American churches that have just one share in our cooperative. Well, they've got just as much say as the organization that has $700,000-$800,000. And that is supposed to be sort of one of the key pieces. We also raise our money from other investors. So the model in the United States is that it's through a debt instrument, a note instrument. Our investments begin at $250. They are for 1, 3, and 5 years, and they offer 2% rate of return. And some people might say 2% isn't very much for international development, but I would then encourage you to look at our risk mitigation strategies, which are actually quite robust and have been reviewed by third parties, and we've been given sort of the gold star. But the other piece of that is that in accordance with our agreement with the Dutch government as a Dutch cooperative, from the very beginning, we have promised that we will not optimize investor return on the backs of poor people. And so the Dutch government actually gives us tax-exempt status. We do not pay taxes, even though we're technically a for-profit, because of that commitment. So our members come together annually at what's called an annual general meeting, and they vote on that dividend that is distributed. Now, there have been years where they could have done more than 2%, and they've generally said no. So that money goes into reserves. And that means that if we have a bad year because we've taken some risk and we've gone into a country that's had problems, and I would think of like the Philippines, and when the typhoon hit, we had to reschedule all of our loans. We can still pay our members and our investors a 2% dividend.
Hi, I'm David Reno from First Church Boston. I had a question. I'm a member of Service Employees International Union, and I would like to know what we could do as a union to use shareholder activism and possibly get people on boards, since our pension funds are then given to the Treasury. I'm never clear as to what the rights of a individual stockholder is via a pension fund, and whether you could sponsor resolutions or use that activism to change corporations for such things as climate change, et cetera.
So one of the companies that we're very focused on is McDonald's. And we've been really, trying to identify ways for people who are making minimum wage through what we call the Fight for 15, to mm-hmm. at least have at a bare minimum $15 an hour. And big employers like McDonald's and Walmart are huge, huge employers in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And we've had no impact on sort of our traditional ways of going to companies. And, you know, at Walmart, we can't even organize a union. They just shut down the stores. Mm-hmm. So at McDonald's, it's sort of what I talked about before. People are out there on the ground protesting all across the country. Huge action at the shareholder meeting that happened at their headquarters in Oak Brook, Illinois. And so what do we do as shareholders? Well, again, it's really about, I think, pooling our money. As individual shareholders, it's really hard for us to really make an impact. The mutual funds are out there, but we were able to then actually work with a lot of institutional investors, so including Massachusetts, the monies that are in the pension funds there, and just as a collective, go to the board and say, your corporate governance, right, which is sort of, we use our investor language to go to the board and say, you need to look at how the board is comprised, and move it beyond just people in this, they're all from Chicago, it's majority white, it's majority from the same industry, and try to sort of use that power to sort of open up a dialogue through that level, right? And not in conjunction with what's happening with the workers, but just two efforts, really, one on the ground and one through the sort of corporate boardroom mm-hmm. to put pressure on a company to make changes.
I guess my question is, could unions, I'm on the executive board of my local union, could we make a resolution to work together for shareholder activism via this? I do not know if we can or cannot do that, because the laws on shareholders are something of a mystery to me, but nonetheless, it seems like it is a very underrated asset that one could be used if it is not already being used.
So I think our voices in this room are going to be through, again, yours as a union member in Massachusetts, through the retirement funds in Massachusetts, through the other assets that people have as individuals in sort of collective pools, or for those of us here who have money in the common fund, to be able to employ shareholder activism through that fund, right? It gives us a seat at the table that I talked about. Mm-hmm. So I don't know of another way to do it than that. Encouraging, and your locals in Massachusetts are very involved through the relationship with the fund and the state treasurer to try to promote these practices in the corporate boardrooms. But that's, I think, at least what I'm, that's where I'm involved. I don't know mm-hmm. if there are other ways to do it, but that's what, I'm familiar with.
David, I would just say you are right. It is a very underutilized tool, because most people who hold shares in companies do not behave as an owner and never exercise their right to speak as an owner to the company. So it is the rules for actually filing a shareholder resolution are fairly simple. Getting a shareholder resolution actually to a vote is very complex. But you only have to own $2,000 worth of a company's stock for 1 year in order to file a shareholder resolution.
You know, again, very complex, though, to actually get it to a vote, which is why doing it in an organized fashion with others is usually the best way to approach it.
Let's talk afterwards.
Peter Copeless from the First Church in Salem, Unitarian Universalist, Salem, Massachusetts. At a previous discussion regarding the Common Endowment Fund, I think the number that was used was 75% of the endowment is in mutual funds.
The more correct term is commingled funds.
Okay, commingled fund. Could you speak a little bit more about how some of the difficulties you have in using socially responsible concepts when so much of the endowment is in commingled funds? And I think also you mentioned something about some contractual things that I didn't quite understand.
Sure. Each of our managers, you have a contractual relationship with each of the managers. So we have 16 managers, and they're in six different asset classes. And some of those asset classes aren't really conducive to doing socially responsible investment. I mean, that's kind of an overstatement, but that's basically the issue. What it boils down to is domestic equities have a strong base of research. We have a partner or a consultant called Sustainalytics that provides us data about their environmental, social, and governance, as well as whether they have any controversies. And so that gives us a huge database with which to manage 1,000 companies in the Russell 1000, which even just that is a massive undertaking. So when you multiply that out times all of the international issues that we're in, or you take into account the fact that we're buying into the equivalent of mutual funds in the institutional investor world, which is to say, we are not the only investor, and they are not managing it only per our desire or our requirements. So if you want to get access to somebody like a Bridgewater, which is a pretty famous large institutional fund that manages for sovereign nations and things like that, they're not going to specialize, have a little cutout piece that you can put into a pool of money just for yourself, and they will manage it with your socially responsible goals in mind. So in essence, that is the problem. You have fiduciary responsibility, which the investment committee is tasked with by the Board of Trustees. The churches and congregations in the UUA require that money to grow and to be there when they need to have their capital campaigns or when they need the results of those for whatever the project is. And so the first thing that has to happen is the fiduciary piece. And so the social responsible part of it, we try to do as best we can, given the constraints of the financial market. And would you like to, were you?
No, I would just, the fiduciary obligation part, I could say, could be interpreted to mean that you're also in alignment with the values of the church. And that would be my only other, that would be my add-on on that. So,
and I don't disagree with that. I mean, it's clear that in endowments that you take mission into account. So I guess the best way to say it is absolute maximization of profit is not the only goal. Maximizing it to the extent that it is consistent with mission would be probably the best way to say it.
Right.
If I could just one follow-up.
Yeah, sure.
It would seem, though, that would, with so much of the money in these commingled funds, it makes it very difficult for the item that was passed last year, for that. That seems to water down what the intent of the GA was in terms of that motion last year.
The intent of the motion last year was to allow for essentially all strategies, I would argue. Yes, it was labeled divestment, and yes, there was a lot of proponents for divestment, but there's also a strong engagement piece in there. And those items were not put in there idly. The Board of Trustees endorsed that, and that's the path we went down. And so we believe that those pieces are important for good fiduciary responsibility, given the asset mix that we feel like we need to have, as well as allowing us to have engagement with these companies. And as you've heard today, we feel like it's a very successful way to actually go about this sort of thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I just heard somebody say a while ago that with mutual funds, they always vote as recommended by the board.
Well,
I maybe not always. What I'd like to make a pitch for Calvert funds that are really are laser focused on environmental, social, and governance, and they're also very strong advocates of the shareholder proposals.
Yeah. And they're phenomenal partners and have been active on the engagement side for years. So phenomenally strong.
And they're not the only ones.
I guess I should make a distinction between, you know, the mutual funds like the Fidelities and Schwab and Vanguards of the world, and then the firms that Matt works for, Trillium and Calvert and others who actually, they're in a whole completely different category, right? So the SRI funds, social responsible investment funds.
So it's interesting because we do often hear, well, you know, we have the Vanguard fund because it's very inexpensive and we have the market that way and all this. But it's clearly, you don't get the benefits with what we're referring to in those, but you see it often. Anyway, that's probably all I need to say about that.
Hi, Tim Brennan. I'm Treasurer, Chief Financial Officer of the Association and member of First Parish, Needham, Massachusetts. So a clarification, a history lesson, and two commercials. The clarification is, one thing David didn't mention is that among these commingled funds, most of them are environmental, social, and governance managers and SRI managers. Okay, so when we're selecting managers, that's a key factor. I mean, just for instance, on the international side, our manager is Boston Common Asset Management, which is right up there with Trillium as far as outstanding SRI managers. The history lesson is, Vonda mentioned Saul Alinsky, and I don't know if everybody's aware of this, but that's why practically we're standing here today. It was 1967. Saul Alinsky was the Ware lecturer, and they were organizing in
Kodak.
Yeah, but what's Rochester. Rochester? They're organizing in Rochester because Kodak was you know, an almost entirely white company in a community that was over 50% African American. And in the Ware lecture, he talked about if we could just pressure the company using shares, and so the UUA stepped up, filed a shareholder resolution along with UCC, United Church of Christ, and TIAA-CREF, and was ultimately successful in getting an agreement from them. And that was the first ever shareholder resolution on a social issue, and that was the beginning of our work. So two commercials. The first is, if you are voting your shares, in other words, if you own individual stocks or your congregation does, we actually post every single vote that we make in advance on our website, www.uucef.org, and you can go there and you can look and see how the UUA, with the advice of our consultants, is voting those shares. And so that can be a good tool for you. And then the second commercial is, the UUA will match a community investment up to $10,000, including with Oiko Credit. And we love Oiko Credit. We've been with you guys for years. You do fantastic work. So if you make an investment in any community investment or in a microfinance group like Oiko Credit, the UUA will, along with you, invest up to $10,000. And we do that because we love our congregations to get involved in this way.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
Hi, Karen Tobin, First Church, Portland, Oregon. Some of you are really knowledgeable. Some of us are just trying to get up to speed on socially responsible investing. Is there a good newsletter or some documents that you would recommend for those of us trying to get up to speed? I have personal funds in Parnassus. I don't know if you have heard of it. Good. Yeah. But there's, you know, a lot of investment, retirement funds now, they recommend ETFs, and, you know, you have mutual funds, ETFs. It seems to me hard to know, you know, what they're doing with this money, right? So anyway, if there's some base documents you think are good for those of us trying to get up to speed, and also there are baby boomers, you know, your parents are dying and you may inherit a little bit of money. So, you know, this is questions, where to invest. So.
Yeah.
There are a lot of sites that have a list of resources, and uscif.org is a great place to start because it's the trade association, USCIF.
SIF.
SIF, yeah. It was Social Investment Forum, and now it's USCIF.org. And there's a great list of resources there because that's the trade association for all of the social investment firms. And there's a lot of others, but I'm just that would be one that would just get you started. So
that's a great place to start. And then it's not going to be as extensive, but you can find out what we're doing at UUCEF.org as well. And we have a whole section on that as well. UUCEF.org. Yes. Now, UUCEF.org is the Common Endowment Fund website. It'll have performance information. It has a blog. It has a section on socially responsible investing. It defines that and how the UUA sees it. I mean, that I don't know if that's really the foundation that you want, but that will give you some things. That's not really for individual investors, but it will give you some information.
UUCEF.org.
That's right.
I'm Stan Dagler of the Church of Arlington, Virginia. Do you have a definition of socially responsible investment? What is it?
Good question.
That is a really good question. So when Trillium started in 1982, it was to serve predominantly religious organizations, and they had a different opinion depending on their religious group, right? So the Christian scientists have a different definition of what it means to be socially responsible than the Unitarians or a Catholic church. And so the opinion of Joan Bavaria in 1982 is that socially responsible was what you felt was socially responsible, the client. And that was the way in which the firm was built. And so we actually just simply developed the tools to be able to check boxes so that if I have a Christian scientist account, it is excluded from investing in traditional healthcare. If I have a Islamic account, right, we exclude it from traditional financial institutions. And so the answer is it is indeed a very personal decision of what your values are, and what we're talking about is investing in alignment with your values.
Curtis Bell from First Unitarian here in Portland. I'm glad to hear that most of the commingled funds are SRI-related funds, but it wasn't clear that all were. So I wonder, I know that the UUA has made a decision to screen out defense, alcohol, gambling, I believe, and tobacco. So I just wonder if, are we quite sure that that goal is met in all of the commingled funds? Are there this would seem to me an important question.
Tim, you want to help me out with this?
Well, our investment policy treats the direct investments and the commingled investments differently. So the answer is, I'm sure there are some of these companies that otherwise would be excluded that are in some of the commingled funds, but it would be a very small amount. May be zero, but anyway, it is possible for so our absolute exclusions are weapons and tobacco. It is possible for those to be in, but the way we're selecting the managers, we're looking for signers of the principles for responsible investment. We're looking at companies that are incorporating ESG into their process. So it would be at a low level, but it is allowed by the investment policy.
Thank you for all those great questions. If you guys want to take some time, it would be great to work on that sheet, kind of gather in a group if you'd like, and talk about the issues. These are the kind of issues that come up in congregations when you're dealing with socially responsible investing or a strong personality in the investment committee or a number of things. So it might be interesting to kind of work briefly on those handful of questions, like pick a scenario and work on those questions in a group. And if you have any questions about it too, you can come up and ask again. So if you guys want to break up into, I mean, I could make you count numbers, but maybe you could just gather with your neighbors or something and, yeah. Sure, absolutely.
A list of resources, you were asking? Yeah. So we have a blog on the UUCEF.org. And so I can try to, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what to post because there is so much. But if you, for instance, if you send me an email, I could respond to it or I could post some things. It's kind of however you'd like to do it. Okay? Yeah. And you can find me on that UUCEF website under the personnel tab, David Stewart. Okay.
Website, look at how they manage the assets. There's a union member. I wanted to thank everyone for coming today and participating. It's roughly six, and feel free to. I don't think anybody's using the room after this, so if you want to continue the conversation, please do. And if you, in fact, need to go somewhere else, thank you for being here.
That would be
get on the red eye.
I had to be here on Sunday and I had to be back on Monday. Not for work, for a while. Well. It's not my term, but that's what they call it. And what it basically did was it created an
independent entity, yes. So that if there were any legal problems with the UA,
right,
that it wouldn't impact them now.
Yeah. Well, so is there a new subscription agreement?
There's, I don't know if it's actually been sent out or no. In fact, there has been a new one sent out. About 90% of them have signed it, and they're needing to repaper. That's why they call it repaper. They recontract.
So could I? Can I get a copy of the?
Sure.
Or is it already out on the site?
I believe there's a subscription agreement on the UUCEF.org website. But it's if you can't find it on the UUCEF website, certainly I would encourage you to email him or email me, and I'll put you down.
Okay. And then is Susan Halpert still?
It's Susan Halpert.
Okay, that's right. Okay. She's a name that I've been.
Yep.
She's a person whose name I remember.
Yeah, she's his assistant.
And then, did anything then have to change in the UUA bylaws to adjust for the, because there, I mean, there's bylaw language that speaks to
it's really legal and technical stuff, and other folks on that committee handle that.
32 people in our boss.
That would be a Tim question. He would know.
Okay,
but I'm sorry, I can't answer that question.
Aggressive asset management.
How are you? I think we may have.
Yeah, I'm sure we have.
I would agree.
So very nice to meet you. Yeah.
If I could put my money in it, I'm telling you I would.
Anyway, friends of Derek's.
I can't. And so, but I'm absolutely confident.
My husband is actually
down in
the Are you going to go over there?
Yeah. 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 In the Midwest with an investment bank.
There you go.
All right, so I'll see
you. Yeah, right. Yeah,
very good. Well, thank you. It was nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you.
Trainer in Boston.
Tim?
I'm Jordy Pratt. How are you? I'm with Elliot.
We had a nice video. We had, I think, when we were going to plan that event, what happened, we had, it was just a little bit funny because we were in the process of acquiring Portfolio 21. They were going to call themselves a progressive investment. The old name from before they
speaking
named
Susan
Portfolio 20
about
before they picked up the name Portfolio 21 in 99.
The creation of this effort.
And
I'm not sure what you call it.
Sort of like the confusion. Oh my God. Progressive asset management.
And
investment manager.